you know, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to start in 2 to 3 minutes just to allow the latecomers from lunch to find the room and sit down. So 2 to 3 minutes and then we'll start. I think we have a critical mass. I think we're going to start now. So good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming and welcome to this session, technical session 4.3, exploring the feasibility of international financing for social protection systems. We've got a really interesting panel with us today who are going to be approaching this question from different angles. So the session intends to discuss the extent to which a global solidarity mechanism could be put in place in addition to domestic resources and national systems, and what the conceptual basis for a social contract beyond country borders is. Secondly, to put different ideas on the table and explore the comparative strengths and weaknesses of those different proposals, and critically reflect on what hinders or has hindered the effective implementation of those proposals so far. And thirdly, identify options for financing social protection with international sources that seem, in the current context, the most feasible. Now, I am going to kick off by handing... We're a slightly larger panel than fits on this table, so I've got two colleagues to my left, which is a little bit awkward, but Gabrielle and Marcus are going to kick us off with an introduction on a global social contract. And I think Gabrielle Kohler, who's a senior research associate at UNRIST, is going to go first, and then Marcus Kaltenborn, who's at the University of Bochum, will go second. So without further ado, to Gabrielle and then to Marcus.
Thank you very much, Paul, and really excited to be here because we're sort of pulling together different strands of the discussion of the past 4 days. What I'd like to do is briefly situate our discussion in the bigger normative framework of social justice and notably of the Global Commission on the Future of Work, which put a lot of emphasis on the concept, on the notion of a social contract. I would understand a social contract as a tacit or explicit agreement of citizens with their government or of residents of a country with their government. In the ILO speak, it would be the employers, the workers, and hopefully civil society, agreeing on what nowadays would hopefully be a package of public goods and services, which we now tend to place in the UN Agenda on Sustainable Development with the shorthand, the 17 SDGs. Now, over the past few days, many speakers have been referring to the need for national dialogue. So it's not just about an authoritarian state saying, you know, how do we allocate our funds? We know nation states are hierarchical. There are powers at play. There's a need for contestation from citizens, from trade unions. But conventionally, this whole process of a nation state deciding on the SDGs, if you will, it happens at the nation state level, at the level of individual countries. But as we have also heard very, very strikingly over the past few days, is about the 4 billion people in the world who are not covered by social protection, which is the topic of our specific meeting, due to unfettered globalization, the way global production chains play out, the way there's a financialization of capital markets, the whole informal economy growing instead of shrinking, climate change, conflict. So obviously, these issues cannot be dealt with at the nation-state level. And so the argument would be that we need a global social contract. I think normatively, I hope everyone in this room would agree that ethically, normatively, human rights, in terms of human rights, we need a global social contract. But politically, of course, that is not so straightforward because we're talking about a relationship that conventionally has been between citizens in one place with a government in one place. We're now looking at something that's transnational, cross-boundary, has a cross-boundary character. So the question arises, who is responsible? Who can claim their rights against vis-a-vis whom? Who is meant to be delivering and who pays? So the question of this panel, I think, is how to make this case, which is what Marcus now will continue to argue for us.
Okay, thank you. I think Gabriele made it already clear the term global social contract is certainly not meant legally in the narrow sense, but it should be not overlooked that it also has a legal basis. We all know that Recommendation 202 emphasizes that first and foremost, each country for itself has the responsibility for establishing social protection floors. But the recommendation also explicitly says that members whose economic and fiscal capacities are insufficient to implement the guarantees may seek international cooperation and support that complement their own efforts. And a similar approach can be seen in the UN 2030 agenda, which refers to the floor concept in SDG 1.3. It is the task of the governments and parliaments to implement this goal through appropriate legislative and social policy programs. So the national authorities are primarily addressed by the agenda, but there's also another actor whose responsibility for the realization of the global goals should not be underestimated, the international community. Development cooperation is an important pillar of the so-called Global Partnership for Sustainable Development in SDG 17. And this goal, SDG 17, urges states to enhance international support for implementing effective and targeted capacity building in developing countries to support national plans to implement all the sustainable development goals. Now, we could, of course, say that both Recommendation 202 and the 2030 Agenda are merely soft law documents without any legal obligations to the development partners. This is a widely held opinion, but if we take the whole international legal system into account, it is simply not true. The floor concept is quite similar to the core obligations which derive from the right to social security. And this human right is both enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, as well as in several global and regional treaties. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights issued a general comment in 2008, which defines what concretely is meant by social security and describes also the governmental obligations associated with this right. What is now important is the fact that the committee also made clear that there exist extraterritorial obligations with regard to this human right. This means that the states' parties to the convention must take an active part in the implementation of the convention's obligation also beyond their territory. As far as their financial means permit, the richer members of the international community must support the poorer states in their efforts to ensure the full realization of the right to social security. This is a human rights obligation. Even if there is no binding definition of which specific states are obliged to provide assistance and to what extent, the political leaders of the Global North should be aware that they have a substantial contribution to make in order to achieve SDG 1.3 in the near future. Thank you.
So thank you very much for framing that within the larger commitment to supporting in countries with their own national social contracts, but through global solidarity using the instruments of human rights, but also softer law as captured in the SDGs. In UNRIS, the institute where I'm director, the UN Research Institute for Social Development, our research is committed to social and environmental justice, and we've long been interested in obviously the concept of social protection, but also how it can be achieved within the politics of domestic resource mobilization and support from the international community. So I'm very happy to be able to moderate this session today. On our panel to my right, we've got three distinguished speakers. First of all, Michael Cishon from the Global Coalition for Social Protection Floors now, but with a long history in the ILO and in the sector. We have Mareike Weinrochs from the Global Fund, who can talk to us about the experience, the politics, the practicalities of starting and running the Global Fund. And we have Arthur Wood from Total Impact Capital, who's also going to be talking about the potential contribution of private investors who can invest in social good. So let me just start off with just a few framing words, not very many. First of all, to apologise. There were two people who were on the agenda who, for different reasons, some of them very personal, are not able to be with us today. First of all, Her Excellency Sakai Nzina, the former Minister of Public Service and Labour and the current Minister of Industry and Commerce in Zimbabwe, was unable to join us at the end, and as well as Olivia Deschutes, one of the authors of the idea of a global fund for social protection, and he was unable to travel to be with us today. But we still got a great panel, and we're looking for some interesting questions at the end from the audience, some critical questions, some probing questions. So please, as you listen to the presentations, please think about what you may wish to ask at the end. So before diving into the discussion on different options for international financing, let me just reiterate some figures that we heard earlier in the week regarding the challenge that we face. So the global challenge in terms of developing countries as a whole, a financing gap in 2019 of $527 billion for comprehensive national social protection floors and systems. And in low-income countries alone, a financing gap of $27 billion in 2019, equivalent to 5.6% of GDP. So countries are facing, probably more nuanced than this, but three broad challenges. The first is setting up rights-based national social protection systems, including floors, in line with international norms and standards, as well as the institutional configuration of those and the capacity to design and operate them. Secondly is sustaining those systems over time and closing the current financing gaps. And thirdly, and importantly going forward in this century, we'll be safeguarding those systems against shifts which will happen in technology, in employment, in demography, in climate, that could threaten the sustainability of the systems being put in place. So I'm now going to turn to Michael Cishon and ask you, you've previously been an advocate, a proposer, for the case for a global fund for social protection. Could you briefly explain to us what that idea entails and what are the enabling conditions for a fund?
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. I never thought that I would ever get to speak on that subject in this house again. So let me just briefly review the history of this. In 2002, that was actually before the Deschutes paper, 10 years before the Deschutes paper, the Director General of the ILO asked us to explore the feasibility of a global social protection fund. He called it a global social protection trust fund. We actually put a lot of work into this, and thanks to people like Veronica Caruna, I don't know where Caruna is, who spent even years of their life on this, we finally got one pilot of that fund by twinning Luxembourg and Ghana. And so the Luxembourg trade unions collected the money on a crowdfunded basis, supposedly, to finance a benefit in a district in Ghana. The twinning worked well. The fundraising didn't work so well, so they finally gave us, the unions gave us the money from their development fund rather than going to their members because they said it was too expensive to do so, to just get the campaign rolling. So that was the experience there. And 10 years ago, then a few years later, Sepulveda and Deschutes came out with a plan that had two components. One was a sort of subsidy component and a reinsurance component. And in 2015, the Global Coalition that I speak for, at least I speak for 21 members of the Global Coalition, made a proposal for a global social protection fund that had two branches as well, but it was different branches. There's a subsidy for those people that could not, for those countries that could not on a permanent basis, or at least on a temporary basis for 5-6 years, finance all benefits that were required by the social protection floor. And secondly, there would be a part of the fund be used for technical cooperation, largely capacity building, so that, you know, to enhance the operations of the social protection systems in those countries. That proposal, as I said, was signed by 21 institutions from from religious orders to the ITUC, and it was discussed. It did not fly as yet anywhere, but I think we have a proposal to make in the second part. What would the enabling conditions, just very quickly, we have a global consensus on social protection for all. We even have a right to social protection for all, and we even Marcus's position was quite amazing. I think he broke ground there a minute ago, so we should take care and take due note of that. So the global support we have in principle, we have the legal basis for it. There's no need to create a new fund because there's a World Social Security Fund, Social Solidarity Fund, already on the UN books. This is defunct, but it's still there as an institution, or at least as an account, if you want. We don't need to invent mandate and structures, and we now even have a subject matter of the insurance with the social protection floor, because at that time when we started in 2002, we didn't know what is actually, what is it that we're supposed, which benefit, which branch of social protection. Now there's a clear definition that the minimum level of social protection is defined by the poor, by the floor, and we should somehow help to close that gap. The core, as always in these discussions, is the financing and the cost. And I started, I do the cost, and I carry the financing over to the next question, if I may. So basically, the Global Coalition did something that was relatively innovative, I think. It developed an index of the gaps that actually calculated the gaps of social protection at the floor level in 150 countries. And we figured out at the end of that operation, the gap includes the monetary dimension of social protection and the health. That's the difference to the ILO calculations. So what we said is we have 10 countries, 10 to 12 13 countries, depending on which poverty line you're using. We have 10 to 12, 13 countries who cannot possibly finance their national social protection system. All the others can. So we're not talking about 170, 180 countries. We're talking about 10 to 12. And these 10 to 12, if there were a fund that would actually cover half of their cost, half of their bills, because they just would have to spend more than 10% of their GDP on social protection as a tax to GDP ratio that's probably under 10. So there's no way that they could finance it in the next 10 to 15 years. So if we were helping them, if somebody was helping them to finance half their cost, not all, because you can't take all responsibility away, then we would need somewhere between 10 and 15 billion, what more? That's 1% of the global military spending, right? It's still double the size that you have in contributions and allocations, I think, roughly on the long-term average. So yet it's small in terms of military spending and global GDP, but it is quite an operation in terms of setting up a fund like that, given by the measured by the experience of the Global Fund. I'll rest it here for a moment.
Great, thank you. And now, just before I turn to Maraiki, because you concentrated on the financing gaps for the proposal for a slightly more limited number of countries. Maybe I just give Marcus a couple of minutes to explain, the reinsurance bit of it that Olivier might have covered if he'd have joined us on the panel.
Yes, okay.
I will at least try to do it. De Schutter and Sepulveda, the two former UN special rapporteurs, have suggested a setup a global fund that would consist of two branches. The first one would be a facility branch whose task is mainly to close the funding shortfall between what least development countries can reasonably pay and what it costs to provide a social protection floor. And the second one would be a reinsurance facility. The role of this facility would be to safeguard situations where unexpected major crises could lead to the collapse of specific social protection systems. De Schutter and Sepulveda have identified a number of options for a reinsurance facility. On the one hand, a distinction is made between how far the insurance coverage should extend, and on the other hand, various institutional arrangements are proposed. One possible variant could be that a country would reinsure the promise to guarantee the social protection floor. With this option, reinsurance would cover the entire range of services of the floor. The two experts go very far in describing which risks could be covered. Reinsurance could be available for all so-called covariant risks, such as natural disasters, epidemics, the extreme increase of food or drug prices, but also the extreme fluctuation of exchange rates or interest rates, and even armed conflicts. But there is one restriction. Only those risks are to be covered by the fund that cannot already be managed on the country level. In the paper, this is called the so-called principle of subsidiarity of risk management. As an alternative to this proposal, more cost-effective versions are discussed. There would be the option to negotiate a certain range of insurable risks between the government of the developing country and the fund. Or only certain social protection programs are covered by reinsurance. For example, certain particularly important vaccination programs instead of the entire basic health protection which is provided by the country. And on the institutional side, there are also various options elaborated in the paper. One possibility would be that reinsurance would be provided by private companies and that the Global Fund would only take on certain support functions. The second variant is a purely public solution, which means that the fund itself is in charge of the reinsurance. And the third variant would be a mixture of the two first options. This would mean that the fund would only act as a reinsurer in certain areas, while other areas would be covered by the reinsurance industry through the mediation of the fund. Maybe I should add one last sentence that De Schutter and Sepulveda have a clear preference for the public model. The disadvantages they see in the private solution are the dependence of social protection systems on the private insurance markets on the one hand, and on the other hand, the profit orientation of a private sector solution. Thanks.
So of course, we're not starting from even a blank conceptual sheet at this stage. Different types of global solidarity mechanisms already exist, including the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. So, Maraiki Weinrots from the Global Fund, you've been involved in that fund for many years now and from many different perspectives. Looking back at the origins of the Global Fund, what would be your advice to anyone aiming to set up a similar vehicle, in this case on social protection? And I guess also reflecting on the replenishment process, the size of the resource envelope that you're able to mobilize, in contrast to some of the figures that we've heard here today.
Thank you very much. And those are pretty daunting figures. My basic attitude to life is if you don't try it, you will never know. So with that start, giving some background of the experience from the Global Fund. And as you said, Paul, I've been engaged pretty much from the beginning, first as a donor, and then I joined the Global Fund Secretariat in 2013. The Global Fund was basically created in a perfect storm. Around the year 2000, HIV infections were spiraling out of control in low and middle income countries. Treatment was available in developed countries, but unaffordable for the countries that needed the most. What definitely helped to increase the profile was the UN Security Council having a special session discussing HIV as a threat to global security. So that raised lots of political attention, and politicians in developed countries got really scared. Very short afterwards, there was a special session of the UN, United Nations General Assembly on HIV, the first time the UN in special session ever discussed the disease, which again flagged the political attention. Same time, and this also all happened in like 6 to 8 months at time, Abuja meeting of African heads of state attended by Kofi Annan, where the heads of state expressed their concern around HIV and commitment to spend more money in health. And Kofi Annan then called for a war chest to fight HIV. G7 countries had a couple of meetings where they discussed HIV and the need to do more and make treatment available to low and middle income countries. And even before the Global Fund was created, they asked for the creation of a Global Fund and already committed between $1.5 and $2 billion to something that didn't even exist. And we had massive activism in South Africa, very much led by people that were strongly linked to the anti-apartheid movement and demanded access to treatment. And there was a lot of activism in the United States and Europe of people who were HIV infected, who were living because of treatment, and who felt it was a fundamental injustice that they could live and that people who were born in different parts of the world who were HIV positive, still, for them, a positive HIV test was still a death sentence. So it was really unprecedented activism and energy, and that led to the creation mandated by the G7 to establish a working group in Brussels to create a global fund. They started August 2001. And in January 2002, so 5 months later, the Global Fund was launched. I was part of that process, by the way. So we started with a working capital of $1.5 to $2 billion. Initially, all the contributions by donor, they came on an ad hoc basis, and we needed more sustainability, more predictability. So we started in 2006 with introducing a replenishment process. And the first replenishment meeting in London in 2006 raised $3.7 billion for a two-year period. And so we started, it's still a lot of money, but relatively modest. Currently, the Global Fund has an annual budget of around $4 billion in operating, supporting programs in more than 100 countries, low and middle income countries. So indeed, we had our successful replenishment meeting in Lyon in October of this year, where we raised $14 billion for the next three-year cycle. So we'll slightly increase our annual budget to around $4.3 billion. And we've been analyzing quite in depth why we were successful in meeting our target. First of all, we do have a track record now of almost 20 years of delivering impact, and that was really critical. It would have been really difficult to mobilize donors to continue supporting the Global Fund if we wouldn't have had a track record. We had a very strong investment case, so that for donors it was very clear that what they would basically buy for their investment. We had a realistic target. The $14 billion was a 15% increase compared to our previous replenishment cycle, and which was a stretch for donors, but something that was in the realm of possibilities. We've said internally, and I think it's correct, if we would have asked for $13 billion, we would have gotten $13 billion. If we would have asked for $15 billion, we probably also would have gotten $13 billion, because for most donors, an increase over 15% would have been too much of a stretch, would have been unrealistic, they wouldn't even have tried. We had very strong advocacy. There's still a very strong activist movement around the Global Fund in the north, and increasingly the biggest advocacy movement is in low and middle income countries. We have a very inclusive board, quite a large board, with equal representation of donors and implementers, with civil society, communities affected by the three diseases, private foundations, private sector, all involved. It's not always easy to manage a very diverse governance mechanism, and it feels at times as if you're herding cats. At the same time, that same inclusivity means that our own board members are the ones that will lobby as hard as possible within their own agencies to either advocate or to increase contribution. And we have very strong political support, having President Macron host a meeting, and he was absolutely on fire during the replenishment meeting in Lyon. There he, at the beginning of the meeting, said, no one is leaving this room, no one is leaving Lyon if we don't get the $14 billion. And even as we were finalizing the calculations, he was calling heads of state and said, we're almost there, can you give a little bit more? And actually managed to raise another 200 billion in like the last 30 minutes. Very strong support in the United States. United States Congress, they increased 15%. UK increased 15%. You talked about the political context. We were really concerned that with the political context in the United Kingdom and the United States, it would be really difficult to even maintain the high levels of contribution. But I think, again, they're coming back to demonstrated impact. We managed to increase even in difficult political settings. Just some reflections, and I know nothing about social protection, so forgive me if I say really stupid things. But just listening, I think it's really important if we reflect on what lessons we can learn from the Global Fund and to some extent from Gavi. Like, who are your stakeholders and who's your movement? Where's the energy? Do you have strong civil society engagement? Do you have a similar degree of activism around the creation of a social fund, the Global Fund for Social Protection that really has been driving the creation of the Global Fund? And a lot is already happening at country level. I know from when I worked with the Dutch ministry that we were supporting a couple of HIV-sensitive social protection programs. So a couple of countries have multi-donor trust funds. There's a whole range of agencies involved. Like, what's currently in place and what do you need in addition? You need the additional money. Do you need a global fund to raise that additional money? Do you want to focus at the national level and expand what's happening at the national level? And what's the focus? Because just listening as a total layperson, it's that the scope is still quite huge, from something that could be quite focused to something that would indeed aim to cover a 527 billion funding gap, which is going to be impossible to... I'm a hardcore optimist, but if that's your...
the national.
Yeah, but and anyway, so the gaps are enormous. So you have to be really realistic in defining your scope if you want to be successful. Thank you.
Just one follow-up question, if I may. Let's assume the financing gap is the same for the global fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria, and also the proposed fund, depending on country coverage, etc. I mean, of course, the development discourse has moved on in the last 15 years from the birth of the Global Fund. I use very short language. I don't want to mischaracterize the MDGs, but it was an aid agenda. It was north to south. It was about transfer of resources. It was focused on poverty and social development, and it was sectoral. And therefore, the proposals made at the time for funds in those sectors could get political attraction because they were focused on incredibly concrete things. In this sort of new development discourse where you have an integrated, holistic set of goals with, if you like, overlapping benefits when you invest in one, also the idea of social protection, we know that it has so many benefits for so many areas of life, but it's a bit more, it's floating above all of those hard sectors that people can actually sort of buy into. You mentioned a strong investment case. And, of course, there was quite a strong critique of vertical funds as well. So is social protection horizontal in terms of its coverage, or would it be dominated by a vertical finance mechanism which comes with transaction costs for recipients? So, I mean, how do you deal with this vertical fund critique in the Global Fund?
How we deal with it on a very regular basis. And I think especially when the Global Fund was created, it worked in sort of rounds of in a competitive system where countries had to submit proposals, and that induced and incentivized a certain verticalized approach, which we knew at that time at the beginning it might have been justified. Long term, it's not sustainable, and we should move away. So if you look at our current strategy and even the investment case, because we asked for 15% increased investment from our donors, we asked for a 46% increase in domestic resource mobilization for health overall. And because it's very clear, if you want to have a sustainable impact, you cannot operate as a vertical fund. You have to invest in health more broadly. We need to see domestic resources for health increasing. We have a very strong focus now on what we call resilient and sustainable systems for health, which is basically the former health systems reaching out and engaging communities. And if you know, I was just looking yesterday at the UNH report that came out yesterday, It's now the majority of infections take place in key populations that constitute a small proportion of the overall global population, but cover 54% of new HIV infections. So we have to focus on gender inequalities. We have to focus on human rights barriers to access. So by need and by definition, we have to be more horizontal.
So let's take a slightly different angle into this discussion then. When the SDGs were agreed by governments, there were some shockingly high numbers put forward by UN agencies and others outside about the cost of achieving the SDGs, and it seemed very daunting. And of course, if you were to add up domestic resources, are the largest source of financing for the SDGs, but in some countries they need supplementing by private international transfers through ODA. But even when you add up all the ODA figures, they're tiny in comparison to the estimates of what it would take to achieve the SDGs. It takes you into the territory then of how do you rewire private spending of individuals, of companies, towards things which have external spillover benefits, i.e. reach the SDGs, and away from those which have external negative disbenefits, the costs. And so whether you like it or not, and we've already heard a hint of an earlier sort of scepticism of private sector financing for the SDGs is very much on the table. And so Arthur joins us on our panel, and I'm not going to give them a name because I think the beginning of our conversation started about social impact bonds. But overall, I think the overall question is, you know, is it... How can the private sector, why would the private sector invest in anything that, you know, was in the social sphere, social protection, even AIDS, TB and malaria? What's the case? And then what are the vehicles that would allow them to do it? What are the risks? What are the governance questions around that sort of setup? Arthur.
That's a relatively short question. Let me, being an ex-banker, start with the problem. Because we flagged it. The SDGs, if you read the UNCTAD report recently and the UNSG's report, are currently $3 trillion short. They've fudged the climate accounting. It ignores the demographic deficits that are in most Western countries, and indeed China with a time lag. It ignores 1.7 times the world's resources and doesn't even mention AMR, antimicrobial resistance, that the WHO are going to tell you is anywhere up to $125 trillion problem. So it is demonstrable that the gap is huge. And yet when you look at the vehicles and the methodology that academics would say could crystallize social value, they would talk about four values. They would talk about tax and regulation. And there's not to say that there can be very good things done about illicit tax flows around regulation. But if you think about it in very broad terms, they're strategically unaligned. Well, we know government hasn't got enough money as a function of being successful in terms of pensions and health liabilities. So the government, the money's not going to come from there. If you take a look at regulation, well, foundations have $1.5 trillion that sits on their balance sheet, but 95% of that is unaligned with their social mission, and they give around 5% of it away. So clearly, if you just put this in context, Gates's total giveaway in any one year is what the Pentagon spends in 36 hours. So the money's not going to come from there either. Now, if you look at subsidy, there's $170 billion inside the entire Bretton Woods system. There is $100 billion, let's assume the World Bank gets its uplift, and then another $50 billion from DFIs. Well, if nobody in the UN system got paid and they didn't do any of their bread and butter stuff, the amount of leverage would have to be somewhere between 20 to 50 times capital. Clearly, subsidy isn't going to do it. Trade, well, carbon trading didn't really work because they didn't set the metrics and the legal framework. So I would argue that when you talk about silver bullets of solution, which is what people usually talk about in their silos, there is a huge problem in terms of how we get it. Because what happens in our sector is that we try to reinvent, and you see it in the city every day, reinvent financial innovation silo by silo, issue by issue, usually at less than $10 or $20 million. And the reality is, in finance, it's all scale. What you do at 2 to 3 million is different from what you do at 5 million. If you get a 30 million, you can create an economic blended value model. You get to 50 million, you begin to hedge your foreign exchange. You get 100 million, you begin to think about intelligent tools. Get a 500,000, you can actually begin to talk about, can we actually liberalise or bring forward the $2 trillion slated to rise to $17 trillion of local currency funds in local pension markets. It's all an issue of scale. And I take my hat off to the concept that we're talking about here today, because it talks about aggregation. And what's the value of that aggregation? Well, if you take a look at Gavi, before Gavi was put in place, injections were $50 per unit. They're now $1.42 heading load. That is all a function of scale and collaboration. Capitalism grows through three things. Innovation, and I used to work for Ashoka, so I'm a passionate believer in it, but it also grows through scale and collaboration. And the problem is that we do not have financial mechanisms that actually create that aggregation scale. We do it within the Global Fund with government doing it top-down, but in terms of the bottom-up and the market actually driving that, it doesn't really exist in any degree of large scale. So where is the value? And I was going to put up a picture. I don't know if somebody could put it up. This is my favourite picture. Churchill, Satyana and Confucius all said that if you want to understand the future, you need to understand the past. And this is a picture by Niccolò da Michelino. Any of you who've been to Florence, you'll recognise it. And on the left-hand side, he's pointing to the seventh circle of hell. And on the seventh circle of hell, you find blasphemers, sodomites, mass murderers, and bankers. And on the right-hand side, he's actually looking at the dome, Brunelleschi's dome, which, of course, was built by Medici, the banker. So there's always this tension in history between the two. And indeed, there's a very credible argument to make that the Medicis funded the Renaissance. How what's more interesting about this picture is the Medicis, of course, created the bond market that became the basis of the modern nation state. If you go back to the Templars, the clash between the church and the state was funded by the Templars, who were the first bankers that created the first letters of credit, the first trusts, the whole range of financial products we now take for granted. If you go forward to 1750, the ultimate apogee of the crisis or the conflict between nation states between the French and the British. Why did that wet, soggy island off the coast of Europe become the dominant power, although it was half the size of the French in 1750? Why? Because we nicked from the Dutch the concept of central banking, the concept of corporate structure, and indeed an efficient taxation system. So whereas the American Revolution, a side event in this event, though I know Americans don't see it like that, bankrupted the French, we, courtesy of the Dutch, could continue to fund the Austrians, the Prussians, the Russians, and everybody else to fight the French. Bretton Woods is a symbol of American dominance. There is a point I'm trying to make here. All the way through history, the turning points of history have had a financial dimension to them. They have been absolutely critical in terms of the rise of one power over the other. And I put it to you that where we are today with an existential threat of climate, $3 trillion short in the SDGs, $250 trillion of borrowing by everybody, just to put that in context, the American GDP is $20 trillion, with interest rates at 160-year low, with Goldman Sachs saying the markets are now the highest they have been since 1905, we have a bit of a problem. And the solution to that is to ask what historically changed all those turning points of history. It has been legal and financial technology that have actually created those changing points. All the way from the Templars. And it is the same history if you look at the history of foundations, the history of donor advisor funds, community development funds. You see the original financial innovation, but what scales it is legal and technology. And what has revolutionised every other aspect of your life? It has been technology. It has been personalisation, customisation, mobile, cloud, and now distributed ledger technology. And I put it to you that if you marry those five technologies, the same revolutions that have been applied to other sectors of the economy can be created within our sector to actually aggregate around social issues, to actually drive scale and drive financial tools. And the final point I will make, because I recognise I'm speaking too long, is the value is in what we talk about. So in the Global Fund, they will tell you for every $1 you put into TB, it generates $45 of future economic value. You do it quicker, it's 85. If you look at education, $1 you put into Education India generates $55 of future economic value. Look at the Copenhagen consensus. I could go on. The value is in the outcomes and recognising those as future cash flows lost, and like carbon trading, make that tradable. That is where the opportunity lies. It is not about us throwing silver bullets at the four horsemen of apocalypse.
So just by way of follow-up, so in one sentence then, there is the potential to mobilise private finance even in social objectives, but the return to the private sector is a share of the economic value created in the future, essentially. That's
absolutely, and a critical point, that the community actually are stakeholders in that process. So I'll give you an example. There are, for example, $2 trillion that sits in local pension funds in local countries, currently unaligned with their own essential sustainable development. Maybe, and we were involved in a $600 million funding. It got shot apart by the rating agencies, but the figures were that the IRR was roughly 25%. There have been roughly $45 billion worth of these structures done historically. Clearly, if that type of return is in place, if these local capital markets were to be aligned, clearly a small percentage, which is the types of figures you need in context, could actually then be directed to exactly the social contract to which you refer. So the issue is not money, and the issue is not innovation. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not amongst the stars. It lies amongst ourselves and how we look at these issues.
Okay, so advance warning, in a couple of minutes I'm going to turn to the audience for questions. Just before I do that, I'm going to give one more opportunity to Michael Sichon to really, based on what you've heard, how do you see the way forward for getting momentum on this agenda for greater investment in social protection?
Okay, 2 points first on your vertical versus horizontal. For me, social protection is as horizontal as it can get. It cuts across population groups, it cuts across life cycles, it cuts across various risks to your income and your health, and it cuts across 11 out of the 17 SDGs, and 27 out of the 169 targets. We always look at social protection at target 1.3. That's not true. If you look at the other targets, if you had a proper social protection system in place, you would sort of solve the problem of 27 targets. So the social protection agenda of the SDG is much bigger than what it comes out in 1.3. That's the case I want to make. Where do we go from here is actually decisive. And I think we have to find a kickoff point for a fund in whatever size it may be. The political return, right? I think if it were, in our figures, if you could support half of the social protection expenditure in the 10 poorest countries, we could help pull 120 million people out of abject poverty in the stationary state, as the actuaries say. That means when the thing is in full swing. Right? So if that's no return, I think this is the best return you can get. But the real key, and that I have to make this point now, the real key is where do you get and how do you get from there? So you should actually get governments to sort of kick into something that they didn't know yesterday that they have the need to do, right? And then Jeff Sachs would come. If he doesn't say, write a letter to me and I get you the money, but if he says, go to the 2,000 billionaires and overcome the hurdle, you take 1% of their income in some form of taxation. In some way or other, you get $4 billion a year, and you should at least fund, you get the half of the social protection, or the need of the social protection fund financed. The problem is these people get rich because they keep their money, they don't give, right? They take, they don't give. So it's not that easy a thing to do. But the other thing, the truth to is that he said is very surprising, or is that you need actually for every billionaire, you need 4,000 average or mean a median US earners to actually come up with the same amount of the 1% that the one billionaire came up. So we would need 8 million people around the world who are willing to give us 1% of their income. At a footnote, there's a 1% club at the UN in Geneva, and there are a few hundred people that give you 1% already. It's not impossible. 8 million sounds impossible to do. But there are 35 million people organized in the automobile clubs in Germany and the UK together. They pay $60 on average per year to actually insure the breakdown of their car, right? Maybe we can get 8 million people around the world to put in 1% of their income to provide to insure against the breakdown of social justice. What it takes is, and that's what we've learned painfully in our own small exercise here in Geneva in the early 2000s, very painfully though. It needs a major campaign, and you need a major will, and you need a major kickoff. And basically you have to convince people that they all can be Gates, they all can be Bill Gates. So there's something like Bill Gates, or there's something like Gates for All by the year 2025, or something like that. You have to kick it off, and you have to kick it out. You have to kick it out today. And I would think we should challenge the Director General in this house. He said, if Kofi Annan can kick this off single-handedly in a meeting, putting the first 100,000 out of his own prize money for something down, and say, look, this is what we can do immediately, and please chip in. If he can do it, the Director General here should be able to do it together with the 25 signatories of civil society, including ITERC, including the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, including Solidar. And if they get out there and say, look, this is what you need to do, if you want to put 120 million people out of abject poverty, you want to do something, and you don't want to wait till governments come to a table and just out of their goodwill, you need to have an event, a kickoff, and you have to shame them into something. We will not be able to finance this in the long run from the private sector. You only have 5% of your income from the private sector, and 80% of that is from Gates, if I do the rough calculation. I mean, Marijke, that's what they did, you figured it out. So the private sector is not the long answer, but it's the crowdfunding that I think is the short answer for the kickoff, and we should actually do it, and we should do it today.
Okay. So we've had some flavour of the scope of the size of the challenge, the importance of the challenge. But then I think, you know, and this is quite right on panels like this, some different views on the contributions of different stakeholders and some design and governance issues, which are incredibly important. Now's the time to take questions from the audience. Can I just ask that you introduce yourself briefly at the beginning, you state your question briefly, and if possible, if you can direct it to one, not more than two members of the panel, and I also ask the panel in their responses also to keep their answers brief. So please, Sylvia.
Hi, thank you. My name is Sylvia Beals. I represent the Global Coalition for Social Protection Floors, working with the Africa Platform for Social Protection. So I've got two kind of related questions, I'm sorry, Paul, but one is about, the main one then, is the noise around a basic income, there's some, you know, political interest in this, is this a distraction from getting the global fund that we want for governments to honour their obligations under the human rights framework? My question. Who to? Possibly Michael, I think.
Yeah, Michael or Gabriel, I'm thinking.
Michael or Gabriel.
Yeah.
Yes. My name is Ken Hirose, IRO Budapest, social protection specialist. I have questions about the this globe, the concept of global social contract. I think as long as we accept this private ownership of income, I mean, the income inequality, rich get richer, is inevitable. So how come what would be the normative basis for obliging the rich country or rich person to transfer their money or wealth to the poor population? Thank you.
So possibly Marcus on that one?
Yes, please. Thank you very much to all speakers. Pascal Anik, social protection specialist for ILO in North Africa. Talking about international financing for social protection, I was expecting to hear a bit about international tax on financial transaction, Tobin tax kind of sources for social protection. So is it out of a momentum now because it was not discussed, but for quite some time it's been... It's been in the loop for financing developing country social protection in developing countries.
Yep, you're right, actually. And I'm going to perhaps ask Arthur and Michael again. And any last questions, please?
Hi, my name is Gemma Rodriguez. I'm not a specialist, but I'm a PhD student. And I would like to ask a question. The right to Social Security was established in 1948, and you know, in 1967 it became a human right in a different way that it was, you know, it became part of the international law. Why is this particular right, you know, has taken a long time to be, you know, put forward there in the agenda? Why is it now?
Okay, thank you. So, any more? We can probably fit one in more if there is a... Yes, please.
Mine is about the role of public finance management. About the role of public finance management, I haven't heard about it in the presentations before, because I understand that there is a lot of money lost in corruption, and that can potentially also be harnessed to finance social protection. What are we doing about it?
And I wonder on that one if there are any lessons that you've learned from the Global Fund and its mechanisms of working with government. I'm sorry to pass that one on to you, but it's a practical... Okay, and then you can also say something about that.
So maybe I'll start on my left, then with Gabriel, Marcus, and then we'll take a note of it. You could contribute
to all
of
them,
but
that's
not every single
one, because you didn't have to. That's
all that was. But Gabriel. Okay, thank you, Paul. I think universal basic income versus social protection floor kind of arrangement, that is, I'd have a personal view on that. I think that the social protection floor with the four guarantees or the convention on social security with those eight areas that need to be covered is more specific than if we have a universal basic income, which is very generic and we don't really cover for the different kinds of situations in which vulnerable people are. But I think that would be a discussion sort of in the second degree, as it were. One would look at this funding and then say in each country or in groups of countries, what is the best mechanics for delivering transfers, including social services and public goods, but also in terms of social transfers and actual money benefits, what is the best mode of delivering that that's really equitable, that's gender equitable, that's equitable for socially disadvantaged and socially excluded groups, remote areas, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that would be, I don't think it's a distraction. I think it's a welcome discussion that we need to have. And I think Bien, in France, the originator maybe of the basic income grant kind of thinking, I think they're converging a bit with the social protection floor kind of crowd, and that would I think it would be a productive discussion. If I may, Paul, can I take up one of the other questions about the public finance management? Because something that we haven't talked about is all the other streams that need where we need to take action. There's a big request from many, I think it's the G77 countries, to create a UN-based global tax body that would actually regulate a lot of this illicit or, you know, playing with locations so that countries evade or avoid or actually don't pay their taxes. There's a big movement on a binding treaty on business and human rights, and if that were to come into force, and a lot of our northern countries are actually opposing it. If that were to come into force, we would have a very good mechanism to actually look at some of the global and nation-level income inequalities. There's a convention on the rights of migrant workers, which would regulate how migrant workers actually, what the transaction costs are for their remittances. That was something raised in an earlier session. But it would also stop this, this pyramid of payments between lower income and higher income countries and poor people from poor countries coming into households in richer countries or into factories and production sites. So I think we need to look at many different parallel arenas, bring them together, and then I think from that human rights kind of discourse, we could make a big pitch for this kind of a fund, which would be an equalizer, perhaps, if it worked well. Thank you.
Yeah, there was the question. Thank you very much for this question on the legal obligations. I see it, already told you, in the soft law documents on development cooperation, in the Agenda 2030, and in several other soft law documents. But these soft law documents reflect in main parts the human rights obligations, and these human rights obligations are binding law for nearly all countries in the world. You know that not all the covenants have been ratified by all the countries in the world, but nearly by all countries in the world. And of course, there is primarily a human rights obligation of the governments with regard to their own population. This concept of extraterritorial obligations is nothing completely new, but it has been debated not in the first years of these treaty obligations. And it is coming up as a debate. In the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, we have several reports, meanwhile, where these extraterritorial obligations have been put up with regard to the obligation to protect people in other countries. So, for example, governments have the obligation to protect people in other countries from human rights violations which have been come up with regard to their companies. If a German company or an American company is violating human rights in foreign countries, then there is an obligation of the German or the US government to protect these human rights. But it has not been debated with regard to the obligation to fulfill human rights, and the right to social security is a right which has to be fulfilled. Has, of course, also to be protected, but mainly the obligation to fulfill this human right is addressed by this right to social security. And until now, it is still in the academic debate, not so much in the political debate, but I do not see any differences to the other extraterritorial obligations. So there is a strong legal basis for such an international financing mechanism in international human rights law. Thank you.
Thank you. For this panel, maybe I'll go in reverse order, if I may. So I'll start with Arthur at that end, please. Specifically the
Tobin tax. The problem with the Tobin tax, I mean, it's great at concept. The problem is it gets into actually how do you enforce it? Because the French and the Germans are always very keen on the Tobin tax in the European context because, of course, 70% of investment banking is done in London and 60% of private banking is done between London and Switzerland. So it would be the Brits and the Swiss that would be paying the tax. Just to give you an example of the complexity of those sorts of issues, Brexit. You can't have any conversation without Brexit or blockchain. The European Union can enforce, just to give the example, the European Union can, of course, enforce European companies to not trade through London. The reality is they can only persuade European companies to do that, which is 25% of the market, and you then create a dual market with 75% of it in euro transactions being done offshore. And you create a market between the two, which will create an additional, according to the Bank of England, another $20 billion worth of frictional costs that the European taxpayer will pick up. Now, the point I'm making there is not one side or the other about Brexit. The point I'm making is the complexity of these issues lies in actually how you would globally do that between the major financial jurisdictions, first point. And secondly, how do you then measure that? Because when you do a financial transaction, at which point in the cycle do you actually take the tax? It's a great idea in concept, but when you get into the granularity of doing it, I would suggest there is a much more interesting element in terms of how you use the tax system. Why, for example, do we not think about using the tax system to pay around social outcomes as opposed to actually giving the money away? Because at the moment, what you're doing is creating a mechanism that creates fragmentation in the system. Why not create a mechanism that actually incentivizes collaboration with the tax system? If you think about using the tax systems in other way, I would argue in terms of using the capital markets, there's a far more interesting argument here about somebody making a contingent payment. I want to be clear about a contingent payment. If you are in the city of Cairns, 1 million people a year visit the city of Cairns because they want to visit the Great Barrier Reef. If the Great Barrier Reef dies, all those businesses are out of business. If you're the Indian government, 3% of your gross national product every year is accounted for by bad sanitation. There are a whole range of issues where you could see a range of stakeholders that would be prepared to not pay up front, contingently pay. So they make an offer to pay. And you take that and you create a mechanism whereby the quicker you achieve that outcome, the higher the return. So you effectively equitize the problem. Now that, I would argue, is a much more interesting concept in terms of mobilizing capital than trying to actually work out how you can tax the current system, which is clearly not going to play ball in terms of exactly what you want to do, given the complexity. So I think there's a range of things you can do with the tax system, and there are things already done. For example, the program-related investment rules in the United States. These are already done, but they need leveraging and being much smarter about them and not looking at things like the Tobin tax, because I guarantee you financial institutions will find a way around it.
So, Muraki, on billionaires and public financial management.
I have opinions, not questions. Now, just to add to the Tobin tax, I think apart from the practical implementation issues that Arthur mentioned, I don't think there's any agreement whatsoever on what then, even if it would be introduced, what the funding should be spent on. And I think the funding has already been spent three times. So the climate, health, social protection, national budget, there's so many ideas people have on how, if there would be a Tobin tax, how that money would be spent. So additional complexity. On PFM, absolutely. And so PFM is important to increase the overall funding envelope, but it's not a panacea. And I think it's both encouraging and frustrating. If you look at the ask, it always small ask in the grand scheme of things. If you look at defense budget, if you look at the money that's disappearing in illicit financial transactions, even if you look at the money the world spent on Christmas presents or for Valentine's Day, it's always a very small ask. And if you look at it, I think it was 1.7% of GDP that was needed to fully cover developing countries. Countries should be able to, at the global level, we should be able to mobilize that amount of money. But at the end of the day, it comes back to distribution of wealth, and which is always requires a lot of political courage and decision making. It is always difficult. On billionaires, we have very active fundraising amongst what we call high net worth individuals, with great support from Bill Gates. We have a couple of people, billionaires, in countries like India, Tanzania, Indonesia, that want to support health in their countries, but they basically mistrust government. And so they're okay to fund through global funds, sort of to to piggyback on global fund supported programs because they know that all the checks and balances are in place. They would be very hesitant to provide even 10% of that money to the government because they don't trust the government. And they also don't like paying taxes. So that's the reason why they're billionaires. So it's absolutely, theoretically, there's lots of money available, but making that into real money on the table is really difficult.
I had two that I was implicated in. Sylvia, I don't think that necessarily the basic income debate distracts from this. The basic in the recommendation 202 on the social protection floors, it doesn't stipulate the means by which you close gaps. So, and there's a continuum from sort of strict social assistance to universal benefits, and the basic income fits into there. I think it's up to the government and up to the society to do this. But I don't think you can probably have a fund that finance a universal basic income, because basically that doesn't close just the gap, it closes more than the gap, right? So that you have to define very clearly what a fund would do. And while it's legally within the SPF, and there wasn't a conflict as yet, there it probably would emerge. So I wouldn't hide it. The financial transaction tax, Pascal, yes, it would be nice to have. And the estimates that I've seen go from 200 to 300 billion a year. So we would only need a fraction, even after climate. We would only need a fraction of that. I think, and make my key point in the end, the question is how to get from A to B. Yeah. The bankers will tell us it's too complicated. I'm not saying that Asa said that, but the bankers will say it's too complicated. The international, there will be tax competition. There will be tax avoidance. There will be everything. And you can't, it's too complex. And it will distort the market at a rate of 0.01% of the transaction. I don't think it distorts anything. But there's always, but it is very difficult to administer. If it were there, it would probably solve all problems. The key problem that we have is how do you go from A to B? We've been on A for 20 years saying, knowing what we need to know to actually get something on social protection earmarked funding. And social protection would include health. I say that again. The ILO tends to neglect it in recent years. It includes health as a systemic financing of healthcare. I think we need to do something, and we need to turn to societies rather than to individuals and rather than to governments at this point. And that's why I said if you ask people to contribute 1% voluntarily, you may get a further kickstart, a better kickstart than if you wait for governments, financial markets to have to react, or the financial markets to react, sorry. I leave it here.
Okay. A round of applause for the panelists. We have reached, I think, the end of the allotted time, and I know that Myra has to take something back to show what comes out of the session. And it's difficult to do that because, we didn't really obviously get very far into some of the debates which are really important around governance, public versus private, etc. I've just taken a note of four things, and maybe afterwards, if they disagree, the panel can work with me on refining those. But I think the first thing that we heard quite strongly was that, social protection isn't a sector. It's not one thing. Social protection is important for many aspects of people's welfare and their capabilities to live their life well. Now, when you're trying to sell that as an investment proposal, it's a little bit more difficult. But actually, we have the evidence to show how important social protection is for nutrition, for education, for other aspects of health. So that evidence is there, but that's the case. Social protection is not just a thing in and of itself. It's important for many areas. I mean, secondly, we heard there are different ways of doing this. And on the one hand, of course, domestic financial resources have to be the cornerstone of long-term sustainable social protection systems. Now, where there are financing deficits, we want the international community to show its solidarity in the context of a global social contract to support those countries that want to put in place those social protection floors. But at the same time, the resources to do that are hard to get, and the political economy of shifting the distribution of taxation systems and introducing new tax coordination and international taxes such as the Tobin tax is just really, really hard to do. I've been a member of the Tobin tax campaign for 20 years in the UK, and it's very difficult to shift that agenda. On the other hand, I think we can understand and appreciate the business case for capturing as an investment vehicle a part of private investment in future economic value created. But at the same time, there's a lot of scepticism about the motivations of the private sector and moreover, how that system is governed overall. And so those two communities are really not talking still at the moment. Thirdly, I think we heard that actually you don't need to start with a multi-hundred billion dollar fund. You can show proof of example in a more limited number of countries that face particular constraints in financing social protection. You bring the ask down, you bring the ambition down, but then it shows that it's possible. And above all, this is a political question. This is a political question where member states have to engage and work together. And then fourthly, and Marcus touched on this, is that you have the initial challenge of getting social protection systems off the ground and financed to some degree. But you've got a whole host of problems coming in the next decades around demographic change, around technology and jobs, around climate shocks that are actually going to impact on the sustainability of social protection systems in all countries. And therefore, thinking about mechanisms for ensuring those systems against future shocks is also going to be important. And within that, the same debate on public-private plays into that too. So that's how I would take away some of the main messages from this session. I thank you very much for your interest and your participation. And thank you also very much to the coordinating team who set up the event, my own team from UNRIST who are here filming it to make sure that it has a bigger footprint outside of the meeting. And of course, last but not least, to our panelists and speakers. Thank you.